there's an old Algerian folktale that I read last year about a philosopher and a ferryman. This philosopher was on a long journey, and he came to a really great river and needed to get across. And so he found there a ferryman who, you know, spent his days bringing people from one side of the river to the other. So he made an agreement to pay him, and they got going on the water. And as they were rowing across, the philosopher asked the ferryman, "Brother, have you ever studied mathematics?" And the ferryman said, No, I never have." And the philosopher just nodded, and he said, "You've wasted half your life." They kept going. And he said, "Well, brother, have you ever studied philosophy?" And the ferryman said, No, I never have." And he said, "Oh, you've wasted more than half of your life." And just then this big gale came and capsized their boat. And both men fell into the water. The philosopher starting to go downstream, and the ferryman said, "Brother, have you ever learned to swim?" And he said, "No, I haven't." "Then you've wasted your whole life." That's really all we're doing here. Right, we sit down, we start to pay attention, and we see that life is just this constant stream of experience, changing sensation. All these sense experiences, the mind, that are just so overwhelming at times. Sometimes they're calm, sometimes these storms come up. And we find, and part of what motivates us to be here is this realization that we don't really know how to swim. You know, we've managed actually pretty good, pretty amazingly, right? Considering how much training we have had in our lives growing up, trying to survive in this world. It's like you learn enough... if you're lucky to be able to, you know, manage the sort of basic currents. But we all can see that there's a deeper capacity, right, to be with life as it's unfolding, to maneuver, to manage the heart and mind and body through these turbulent waters. And so we come to practice to try to learn how to swim in these sometimes calm, sometimes wild currents of life. It's a very beautiful proposition. And as you can see, whether this is your 30th retreat or your first retreat, that, you know, it's humbling. These things catch us off guard. We get bewildered. We get turned around and confused. We don't know which direction we're heading in at times. But we start to develop little by little, you know, this faith and the capacity of the mind to be able to manage reality, to be with life in a fuller way, to swim these wild currents. the Buddha said, about his motivation to seek freedom and the nature of the path to liberation of the heart. Seeing people floundering like fish in small puddles, competing with one another. As I saw this, fear came into me. The world was entirely insecure. All directions were in turmoil. Wanting refuge for myself, I saw nothing that wasn't laid claim to. Seeing nothing in the end but competition, I felt discontent. But then I saw an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in the heart. Overcome by this arrow, one runs in all directions. But by simply pulling it out, you don't run, you don't sink. I call greed a great flood, a whirlpool sucking one down, a constant yearning, seeking to hold. Whoever has gone over and above sense desire, an attachment hard to transcend in this world, doesn't sorrow, doesn't fret. Freed from bonds, their stream is cut. Burn up what's past and have nothing for the future. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you will go about calm. For whom in every way there is no sense of mine and doesn't grieve for what is not, they in the world aren't defeated and suffer no loss. To whom it doesn't occur, this is mine, and for whom nothing is others. Feeling no sense of mineness, they do not grieve at the thought I have nothing. Not harsh, not greedy, not perturbed, everywhere in tune. This is the reward, I say when asked, for those who are free from preconception. For one unperturbed who understands, there is no accumulating. Abstaining, unaroused, they see security everywhere. I feel like that is one of the most beautiful statements that the Buddha made about liberation, how to get there, the pain that actually can motivate us at times to free the heart from these bonds. And it can help us understand what the point is of what we're doing here, you know, that why we're going through everything that we're going through, and what is the point of an insight into impermanence or dukkha or anatta, non-self, right? How is it that's liberating, right? This quality of, oh, for whom there is no sense, this is mine. They do not grieve at the thought, I have nothing. How to manage this just wildness of experience, right? This like fish floundering in small puddles, running in all directions. And you know, that word greed is, again, it's like kind of, we talked about the translation as like a, you know, interesting piece. It's actually can be hard to appreciate sometimes, because in English language and, you know, culturally it's such a judgmental word that it's hard to, you know, and we might not think of ourselves as greedy, you know. But you can see, really, it's just talking about this much more basic underlying current of you know, craving for a pleasant experience. A constant yearning, seeking to hold. Right? It's not about being greedy. It's just this deep pain in the heart, seeking to hold on to experience that's fleeting. Right? Natural part of, and again, it's like you're talking about the other animals. It's like, it's a deep part of our evolutionary makeup. Right? And yet it's a prison. It's painful. It causes this kind of anguish in the heart. So this process of like going from seeing the world as entirely insecure to seeing security everywhere. Not because you've changed the world, not because you've manipulated things, not because you've learned to control things, but because one understands. One who understands there is no accumulating. And so that's all, again, you know, this reminder of like all we're trying to do is understand what's going on moment by moment. And that's, you know, that as hard as it is, you start to see that it's possible. that thankfully we don't have to think about the future or the past, right? Burn up what's past. If you don't cling to what, you know, what does it say? Burn up what's past, have nothing for the future. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you'll go about calm. All we actually need to concern ourselves with is this very small moment in time. And it's always moving. It doesn't last very long at all. And so there can be a relief in that. It's actually, there's a sense of like, okay, you don't have to pay attention to everything that's always happening. It's like in this one mind moment, what's happening? And starting to see that actually even sometimes our investigation that we talked about can be a kind of clinging to it, right? Because we're trying to kind of get in there and pierce it and understand what's happening. So it gives you a sense of how actually relaxed the investigation needs to be, because you're investigating it, but we're also letting it go. It's a hard thing to do. We're often trained to like, you know, like hunt. Not that we're all trained to hunt, but that that impulse, right? Of like you zero in what you want and you get it, you know, or you push it away, or you know, you kill it, or you get it, or whatever. Versus like you zero in on it with a lot of intensity, but then you just let it go. That's a paradoxical thing for the mind to learn how to do. So it takes, you know, it takes a lot of practice. But it's really possible. And then not only is it just this one moment that we need to worry about, the present moment. And really, you know, take that in as much as possible. Over the days that are left and the time that's left, it is amazing to see how sometimes we think about the future as, oh, what's going to happen tomorrow, or what's going to happen when we get home, or in the next year, or the next few years, or 10 years from now. The future is also just the next moment. And it is amazing to see how frequently we are invested in what's about to happen, right? What we think is about to happen, what we want to happen next. And it's understandable, but that's also having a stake in the next moment. It's that nature of that competition, right? Of the hope that the next moment is going to be where we're headed with what's happening now is where we want, is something we want versus something we don't want, right? It's so basic, and we're doing it all the time. Very rarely are we actually watching what's happening in the present moment on its own terms. because we're genuinely interested in it. So if you see that impulse of like, what's next? It's just, again, it's like, oh, it's just this subtle shift of the heart. Of course, right, the Buddha says, you know, all one has to do is pull this arrow out of the heart, nothing else, you know. And then, of course, later he's like, and it's very hard to do, by the way, you know. So he does give us a little bit of credit for that it's challenging. But you just can notice that these shifts can be quite subtle in our energy. And they get more and more refined. It's not like we're always moving these big gears and these big levers. It can be a very subtle shift of seeing, oh, there's just a little bit of this sense of investment in what's about to happen. It's like, okay, you notice it. You notice it because that sense of investment is actually happening in the present moment. So that's a totally great thing to notice in the present moment, but it's actually about the present moment and what's motivating it in the heart. What's that wanting that we might not have seen right beforehand, that wanting of what's happening next? And again, it's like we can feel that, we can tune into that. And in this present moment, you can break it down also very simply. You know, we've offered it in terms of often the sense doors, as they're called, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, the mind. And that's also, that's very wild. That is a lot. Thankfully, we don't have more senses to have to deal with, right, and keep attention on. It's like, okay, that's enough. But even that can be simplified, because you can look at, there's basically, you know, seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, physical sensations, right? Those are all actually body-based. So even though seeing is not a physical experience, it's based on the fact of the body. And you can sort of differentiate that from mental experience, phenomena that's purely of the mind. And so instead of even all the senses, you can just tune into what's, you know, body or mind, nama rupa, physicality, mentality, right? This is a material experience. This is a mental experience. So just that kind of simplification of just the present moment is what's happening, nama or rupa, mind or body. That, to watch it on that level is, can be incredibly, you know, profound. It's designed to be in terms of how we observe the mind, how we observe the body. And how they relate to one another. So there's a, you know, this this quality that we started talking about this morning around mental intention, you know, volitional energy, that starts to become apparent, you know. And again, when the mind is quiet and calm, it becomes apparent. It's not always apparent, you know, in the midst of, you know, a storm at sea. But it can be, right? The mind has the capacity for moments to start to see this quality of what is leading from one thing to the next. And the walking meditation is a great place to explore that. You know, this sense of, okay, so you begin in your standing, and you will not move forward unless there is a mental intention to do so, right? The body will simply stand there. And so it requires the mental intention to begin to lift the foot. And now that can be a very obvious thing. It can be a very subtle thing, you know, that of course, yes, you're thinking doing it and doing it. And then of course there's more and more subtle levels at which happens, because you see that the foot will not continue to move unless there is another mental intention to move. And so you basically have this loop of intention to move, the body moves, that movement causes consciousness of body. You feel that sensation of moving, which, depending on what the mind decides to do, can lead to another moment of intention, right? The, oh, consciousness of body, continue moving. So this moment in one, you know, in one lifting, moving, placing, this is happening millions of times. And you can catch, you know, glimmers of it, this sense of, oh, but that all we're watching is this unfolding stream of mind moments, body moments, namas, rupas, mind and body, mind and body, mind and mind and mind and mind and mind, body, mind, body, mind, body, 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 right? Like, they can all lead to one another. And that's all that's really happening. For the however many years we're on this planet, it's sort of just that. It's a stream of, it can be broken down onto that level of a stream of mentality and materiality. So that's not how we're always going to see it. That's not how we're always going to practice. But it's an interesting place to explore, especially when things start to feel like maybe too chaotic or too all over the place. We don't know where to bring the attention. It's like, okay, that's a mental experience. This is a physical experience. And just noticing that level of things brings you back into some connection to what's happening. And that's all we're trying to do, is to come out from wherever we may be back into a direct experience of the present moment versus the conflagrations and conjurings and all that stuff that can come up around one experience. Is conflagration a word? I don't know that that's a word, but there's something about that. Conflagrations. I don't know. Sounds a little make-believe, but fire, isn't there something about... Anyway, when we teach in Ottawa once a year, outside of Ottawa, at this retreat center that's right by this beautiful river, the Madawaska River. And this summer I was out there in the evening, and I was just watching the river, and there were all these seagulls kind of hanging out on the river further out. And and as the sun started to set and evening started coming along, they're little by little, you know, one seagull would sort of fly into shore, and then another would fly into shore, and there was sort of the slow pattern, you know, this is hundreds of them out there in the water, and slowly, you know, this pattern and rhythm of a couple moving, getting up and going. And so there was this sense of all these seagulls were going to come to shore, stay there for the night. And so at some point during this process, as I'm, you know, watching it unfold, this other seagull comes out of nowhere, not part of this other group, and just swoops into the middle of this flock, and it all just explodes, right? That this, what looked like, you know, this process of moving from water to shore suddenly just blew up, and hundreds of seagulls went up into the air and were churning around and spinning around and moving wildly and squawking and creating a big commotion. And then finally ended up in all these different places, some on the shore, some in the water, some went off into other directions. And it was such a beautiful example of this quality of, oh, of preconception, you know, of seeing how, watching a few things happen and pretty sure what was going on and how things were going to end. And this is what was happening, watching all these seagulls come to shore and sort of starting to take it for granted. And if I hadn't seen this other seagull come from nowhere, I wouldn't have understood what happened, right? In terms of suddenly it just turned into chaos. and ended up in a totally different place. For me, it was such a powerful example of this quality of mind that we're, you know, this potential of the mind to see more and more of these subtle moments that are so powerful. But because we don't see them, they end up having this huge influence on our life that can be bewildering and mysterious and add to so much volatility that we don't understand because we're not seeing it clearly. So that when you're watching the breath rising and falling, or any other object, if the mind, you know, drifts off into boredom or starts wandering and not paying attention, you won't notice, right, when a subtle flavor of doubt shows up out of the blue, right? Some memory happens, very hard to see, very subtle, right? One few mind moments. And then this little doubt sort of has arisen. And then because we haven't seen it, it slowly has this impact, right? It leads to a sense of sadness, hopelessness, despair, right? Suddenly we're in a chaos. We're in, you know, some big tumult about our lives, about whatever it may be. And it's only because we didn't see this little seagull come in from nowhere and set things off in this, you know, commotion. So it's that, you know, it's a big part of what we're watching. It's like you have one subtle visual imprint out of the corner of your eye. You see something that's unpleasant. Rupa, physical, right? That's materiality. You had a physical based experience in the eye door. There was an unpleasantness. It evoked a memory. That memory evoked more unpleasantness. Other memories, frustration, anger. Remember when this person, you know, whatever it is. And then suddenly we're back in not the world as we're experiencing it, but the world as we're creating it, right? Conjuring it around us, how we're sure it is. Very powerful and beautiful to see when we start to catch those moments of like, oh, there's something. It was painful. Feeling that painfulness, feeling the sadness, feeling the unpleasant. But because we're more and more familiar with it, because the mindfulness is strong, it's not upsetting, it's not perturbing, it's not throwing us totally off course. We attend to it. Maybe we send a little loving kindness. Maybe we stay with whatever's happening on that. Maybe we come back to our anchor. But it's that kind of freedom that we're talking about in terms of learning how to swim in these waters. And it's humbling because how much we start to see that we're mostly living in a fabrication. We're mostly living in a dream about reality. And that, it's amazing. It's amazing the mind can do it. I mean, it really is incredible. And it's amazing that it works with all of us. You know, we're all around in these like dreamscapes, and we think of them as really different than when we're sleeping dreams, but it's just that they're, you know, there's a little more feedback with what's actually happening in the body, you know, in our sense experience. But for the most part, we're living in this world of thought, of notion, of concept, of ideas, of opinions about what's happening. And you can see how hard it is to just live in the body, right? To just live in the body, feel these physical sensations, feel these, you know, see these sights, hear these sounds, taste these tastes, know these thoughts as they're arising, know the emotions as they're arising, and just live in that, abide in that, be interested in that. It's just a training. It's just a training of the mind. It's not personal that we can't do it. So we, you know, we take our time. And I like, you know, that there's a Haida myth teller, Skye, who talks about people as ordinary surface birds. And I think that's so important. You know, it's like these seagulls, and you have all these beings who can do all these amazing things, and then there's just the ordinary surface birds like us. And it's actually within that ordinariness that we come to transcend this bondage to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. To our investment in what's about to happen next. It's just through normal paying attention to what's happening. Right, it's not about digging really deep, or when you know, something happens, like I have to get underneath this, I need to get inside it, I need to go deeper. It's like, no, we just skim the surface. You just notice whatever's happening, as boring and mundane and as sort of ordinary as it can seem. That's actually our ticket. It's not about going deep. It's about seeing things deeply, seeing ordinary things deeply. In a way, there is no deep in the conditioned world. Whether you're, you know, talking to the spirits and they're talking back to you, or you're flying around on your magic powers, you know, like all of these things, it's all the same. All of that, dreams, reality, visions, impermanent, suffering if you cling to it, no inherent self in any of it. And so then it's like, okay, we are not looking necessarily for a magical experience, that just what's normal, just what's basic and mundane as the breath of anything, right? If seen clearly, is incredibly magical, incredibly powerful, much more profound than any magic powers we can cultivate. There's a great story from the suttas where there are a group of monks hanging around, and they're sort of sharing stories about what they've heard about the Buddha's birth and how all these miracles that happened, you know. And so there's just, it's just like, it's the most ridiculous thing you've ever read, right? Of like, and the stars shone in the day, and the devas all came down, and the earth shook, and, you know, everything was just like, wow, incredible. And the sense of like, the Buddha just must be so incredible because all of these miracles happened, you know. And, the Buddha overhears it, and he says to Ananda, who's part of that group, one of the ways he would refer to himself or was referred to as the Tathagata, one thus gone. Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Here, Ananda, for the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. It's so pure, right? It's so unfabricated, unglamorous, and something that you can imagine the mind is capable of that. you know the mind is capable of it because there's moments where that's happened for you, where a thought has arisen. You've been aware of it as it arises, as it exists, and as it passes. A body sensation, a sound. That's all this is seeing things clearly. And in that seeing of them clearly, we become disenchanted. We realize there's nothing to grasp onto. There is nobody grasping onto it. Oh, it's just this changing stream of experience. Our ticket to seeing security everywhere through the fact of constant change, constant motion. It's been so heartening to see everybody just out of the hall and just how careful people feel like they're moving, you know, how it appears that folks are really trying to integrate, you know, this practice, moving from one place to the next, not rushing, just taking our time. You know, seeing that it's like, okay, this moment is all we have to explore, and not needing to rush into where we think the exploring moment is about to be once the dishes are in and we go to our cup of tea and can sit on the porch and look out. It's like, no, it's right in every moment is this chance to observe and to watch. It can be great to find our edges around that. I noticed that with the bowing, you know, which is something that started to feel very natural for me at some point of this, you know, bowing three times to the Buddha when you come in the hall, or to a monk or nun if they're in the room as a representative of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, you know, this three bowing. And it was, just for me, it started to feel like it was such a good way to begin my sittings, to end my sittings, with that acknowledgement of gratitude, of thankfulness for the teachings and for this practice. And one of the things I've noticed where we go in Burma is there's a huge range, you know, and some of the folks, because we're in and out a lot of, you know, oh, we have to go visit Sayadaw to decide about the schedule, and we need to, you know, kind of, or we go visit other monks or nuns. And what's fun is, like, some of the folks we work with there, it's like we'll go, and it's a lot. It can be a lot. If you're going to visit a monk a bunch of times during a day, it's a lot of bowing, you know. And you've got a lot to do, you know. It's like, especially you're managing a retreat, there's like, oh, you got this checklist. And so I started noticing that, like, a lot of the folks who were kind of coming in and out of Sayadaw's Kuti and coming from things, they would do like a very fast kind of cheating bowing, you know. It's like you kind of go down once and you sort of, you know, like you don't get your head all the way down. You even, like, even start to kind of, like, lift your hands up, you know, like this, like, tuk, 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 you know. I was like, oh, wow. And then, you know, and you can be judgmental at times, and then suddenly I'm doing it. You know, I'm like, yeah, okay, you know. It's like, Sayadaw doesn't care. Nobody, it's fine. This is how it's done, you know. And it was amazing to see myself get into that rhythm of, like, okay, this is the perfunctory thing you do. And that's all it is. It's perfunctory. And then you get to, okay, the conversation you're supposed to have. And when I went to Mahasi Sayadaw's original monastery meditation center in Seikong, a few hours from Chazwa Monastery, where we have the retreat, there is just this amazing woman who's the caretaker there and the manager of the place. And so graceful and so quiet and so committed and such, it's just such a good yogi, you know, and you can just feel it in every pore of her that she is really trying to be a good yogi all the time, even if she's not on retreat. And so we would, you know, she, as she was showing us around, there are a lot of Buddhas around, of course, right? You go to this hall, you go to that hall, and she would bow so carefully, so slowly, each time, head to the ground, came up, head to the ground, and it's just, it was so moving, and just such a reminder of like, oh, don't be, you know, just, why are you in a rush? This is your, you know, you're trying to, this is your acknowledgement to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Like, God, just take a moment, you know, take it easy. Foul, for crying out loud, you know. Oh, aversion, right? But it wasn't really that negative because it was so inspiring, right? It's like to see someone doing it so carefully, so beautifully. Really amazing. And of course, I'm not always, nearly always that careful, right? Or that gracious in my bowing. But it's there as a reminder, right? It's so solid in my mind, just watching this one person bow carefully. The impact it's had. And so you don't, whether you bow or not is not the important part. It's about where is that thing, you know, in your day, especially here as a yogi, where we forget, you know, where we forget to be careful, to be slow, to be watching, to be mindful, even forget the intention to do it that way, right? It's like, just, again, it's not about being hard on yourself. It's about being inspired by seeing other yogis, you know, I mean, that is such a strength of being on retreat with other people and the Sangha and the community. It's like you see someone out there walking slowly and it's inspiring, it's motivating. It's like, okay, I can do that. We can, and that we build this container together. Very beautiful. I asked one of our monastic friends this year about the issue of sharing the merit, and I was having a hard time sort of with the ideas, you know, that's there of, you know, are we really the owners of our actions? And if we are, then how can you share the merit? How can you share the goodness of your actions if we're all owners of our own actions? And he just said, when you feel good and you do something beautiful, that impact is sharing, you know, that the impact it has on others, on brightening the hearts and minds of others, that's sharing the merit. That's like the goodness of our actions, inspiring the goodness of other people's actions. It's a beautiful kind of responsibility and power of connection. I was on a longer retreat last year, and it was really wonderful to have a long, you know, much longer period of time to practice, and that, and for many reasons, but also to really kind of explore some of this question around kind of intensity versus relaxation. Because, you know, it's that dynamic of, like, we're trying to watch the present moment, And that actually takes a lot of force of mind, right? It takes a lot of the strength of mindfulness and concentration, and it's actually a very powerful ability to do that. But it also requires total relaxation, total rest. And again, it's a paradox. It's very hard to find that balance. And we're not always going to find a perfect balance, because at times we need more energy and at times we need more relaxation. So it's not just about finding that total, you know, everywhere in tune. Of course, that's the aspiration. And there are times where you have that kind of perfect balance. But to get there, a lot of it is, you know, okay, at this time, bringing a little bit more energy. This time, really taking the, you know, taking the foot off the gas, really allowing for a lot of relaxation. And so in this longer retreat, you know, the first few months of it, I just, you know, I really had the energy and inspiration to do very kind of classic Mahasi method of this watching the breath, watching the rising and falling of the breath, doing the noting of, you know, the sensations as they were arising, and just really having that much space to just do that. what a luxury, you know, what an incredible gift. And it was, you know, wonderful, that kind of the force of mind that can be created, that precision, the energy, the concentration that can develop. And then, you know, that was, you know, then about halfway through the retreat, something shifted, and there was just this, an aversion, a healthy aversion to the underlying push that I started to notice, right? The force that was needed to, like, keep going in that way at that point. And so then the next few months were spent relaxing into, like, more and more unbelievably, right? I'm like, really? Like, okay, I'm still noticing this. Like, so it's like, okay, I'm gonna relax a little more, relax a little more, relax a little more. It's like, whoa, like, that's crazy, you know? Okay, you can just keep softening, keep relaxing. And, you know, and so that had a very beautiful, different thing. You know, things might not have always appeared so clear and precise, but it was, for me at that point, a doorway into a lot of peace and tranquility. And so we can get really, I think, caught in the idea that it has to be one or the other, that one of those is right, one of those is wrong, right? So there's, like, the our personality types and what we've heard, you know, there's going to be some where it's like pushing, you know, that's the way. It's like, it's just hard work and pushing, 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 you know? And there's other people where it's like, oh, no, all effortlessness. You can't try to do anything. It has to be totally effortless. And I would just say, before we believe that one of those needs to be true, explore what actually works for you. Like, what is actually helping you get here in the present moment to show up for what's happening? And in my experience, and my experience with, you know, many yogis, has been that, like, both are needed. We need energy. This takes a lot of work. You can see how exhausted you are at the end of the day of doing nothing, right? All day. It's like, oh my God. People do not get it. You know, if you're not into this, they think you're on vacation, you know? And it's like, oh my God. And, yeah, you know, this sense of for every drop of virya, of courageous energy, it's like we need a gallon of relaxation. Just thinking of that kind of balance. But that they're both needed, right? You can't just have one or the other. And then there are times where you can see, oh, there's a little more energy available and you can use it and you can bring it into your practice. You can integrate it. And it, you know, it's good. It gets things going. And then there's times where it's like, oh, you might see that it's, where is it? What's motivating it? Is it just wanting? Is it just aversion? That can happen a lot. Where our energy is motivated by something that's not necessarily wholesome in the deepest way. So it's that sensitivity to the attunement. One of the things that makes me most happy to see in other yogis is this deepening faith. And it's, well, when it's the purest, you know, it's not a faith in how meditation is going to fix ourselves or, you know, make our lives the way we want them to be. Heal the world, heal our families. Our practice can have a lot of power outside of ourselves. Absolutely. But it's very unpredictable, very mysterious. And it's not even a faith in the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha that I think moves me the most. It's this faith just in the increasing ability of the mind to be able to just manage reality. It's a faith in ourselves, because that's all our practice is ourselves. It's nothing else. This thing we call the self, these various aspects of it, of the body and the mind and our emotions and our memories and our history and our hopes and our longings. That's all our practice is these six senses. And that deepening faith in our ability to swim in these waters, to learn how to navigate, to free from these powerfully binding forces. And it requires this, you know, it requires determination and patience and perseverance and carefulness and loving kindness. This care for ourselves, care for our heart, care for others, you know, for our hardships, for our joys. Thoreau said, "I love the wild not less than the good." And I think that if we could really live in that that it would be so profound. Right? That is our ticket. It's just this, the wildness of the seas of the mind, of the body, of all that's happening. If we actually can appreciate it, not just the good, not just what we think is right or think is righteous or think is what should be, but actually what is, in all its wildness and uncontrollability. That's all we're at. It's like, that's what it means to love ourselves. It's to love the wild. To be free is to know it deeply. So we just take our time. Ordinary surface birds bobbing along, just watching what's happening on the surface more and more closely, more and more carefully. Not harsh, not greedy, not perturbed. Everywhere in tune. This is the reward, I say when asked, for those who are free from preconception. To see security everywhere. Let's just sit for a minute.